Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boylow at FS Radio in the studio with Nazarita Goldhammer. We've gotten off to a late start here, but I assure you that we're fully on track. The title of our show today is Critical Design, Beauty, and Virtue. Just give me one moment, please. Critical Design, Beauty, and Virtue. That's the title of today's show. Hope that our listeners are with us, ready to go. Notepads out. Earbuds turned on. Got Nazarita Goldhammer in the studio. So last radio show, we were talking about critical design. And I think that, if I recall, Nazarita Goldhammer mentioned the importance of thinking about beauty. And we were in a discussion about virtue, right? We were trying to create an ethical framework that springs from critical design. So you can't have critical design unless you have an ethical framework. And this is a great lesson for us historically. A lot of times people went out, created science, and all kinds of fancy conceptions about a lot of things, but they didn't really consider the ethical framework. We take it that critical design has embedded within it a penumbra or domain of ethics. And so we've been in this long discussion now about what that looks like. And so the concept of beauty came up. We talk about appreciating a beautiful sunset. There's a design involved in a beautiful sunset, isn't there? You know, there are certain factors, and they all come together, and we say, "Wow, that's beautiful." So what is there in critical design thinking that results in both virtue, which is a way of being a human being that attends responsibly to all elements of that design? That's number one. And number two, how does that necessarily involve beauty? And what does it mean to have a beautiful and critical design? What is the difference, right? What is the difference between critical design and beauty? And I think we should start right there. I'm going to call upon Nazarita Goldhammer, who's in the studio. Let's take it up right there, Nazarita. Why ought we think about beauty when we think about the moral component of critical design?
I think that's what every designer of landscape, of building, of interiors, of building books, building, you know, painting, anything. They always have some intention in mind. And with that is what is beautiful. Now, some people, obviously, there are some who want to do things that are ugly. And so that's their intention. So when I look at design, critical design, I think, where is our intention of beauty coming from? So I look at around me, and there's lots of lawns, green lawns, and I think, are these beautiful, or are these just demarcations of property? And why do humans like lawns so much? Because they are... So what do lawns do? So in critical design, you have to say, what is the function? If something is functional, is it beautiful? I've seen a lot of functional things that are truly, they serve a purpose, but they're not pleasing in any way. Like they don't address something that is pleasing. They're functional. And along comes another design that contains both a pleasingness and a functional design, and everybody that product. They want that product, they want that lawn. And it usually takes a renegade person to go against the grain of what others think of as beautiful. For instance, we were just talking about lawns. I came to the conclusion lawns are, they delineate property, and they serve the function that people want them to serve is that they want green around them. They don't know how to do it, so they mimic lawns everywhere to show that they live in a green space. But I've seen beautiful lawns that have patches of clover, and they are infinitely more beautiful than just a razor-cut lawn. Excuse me. So when we look at design, we have to say, how are we interconnected to the natural world and to others? The truly beautiful design is showing that interconnectedness. Are other people around, or other beings around, other species, other life forms? Do we connect to the earth, or are we alienated? Alienation in human design has its beauty. There are many people that think alienated landscapes are beautiful, and that tells us where we are as a culture. It shows something about ourselves. And sometimes I believe when we change the way we think about something, other things become not beautiful that may have been beautiful to us before. For instance, clothing made out of animal hides, leather. Maybe before it used to symbolize wealth and beauty, and you were smartly dressed, and now it symbolizes that you're wearing the skin of an animal. You're choosing to kill another animal when you don't need to, that you can wear something that doesn't serve its purpose maybe thousands of years ago. Now it's just needless murder. So our sense of beauty always changes. The more we evolve, the more we become intentional, the more we become aware, our sense of beauty changes. It's like seeing in black and white and suddenly seeing in color. Everything changes. Every nuance is different. And what are we striving for? We're striving for a beautiful world that is interconnected with all life and with the earth and with the cosmos. And to have our part in it, but not the dominant part of where we destroy and overcome everything. Because, you know, that in the end is not beautiful.
Well, let me ask you a simple question. What is beauty?
Well, that's what I was really trying to say, is that beauty, you know, they used to have a saying, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And I believe that part of that is true. But I would say instead of the eye is influenced by intention, is influenced by awareness, is that awareness is how are we connected to the rest of the world. Remember, there's lots of books by saints, by masters, by people who have suddenly had an aha moment where the world has changed. The world was the same, but it changed when they had this revelation of interconnectedness. You can read about it in every great religion, in every great epoch of nature and of culture. There are always shamans. They see the world because they're aware. And I think everybody's had this great awakening at moments when they have an aha moment and they see something as different. The same thing, but now it's different. You know, plastics used to be truly looked on as a thing of beauty. Like, oh my God, I got to have plastic because plastic is the new rage. And now in the age where we're looking at nature and realizing how we're destroying the earth through plastic use, we look on plastic and plastic doesn't have its beauty anymore. So I think beauty is connected to our inner selves, to our awareness, and to an awakening of how we see the world. You know, we often talk about Plato's cave. If you're in the cave, you might think that it's beautiful and it provides all these things until you walk out and see this abundant world. And then you think, wow, what I thought of as beauty is not beauty. It was something that where I was at the moment. And so how would you describe it as you, you know, as a teacher, as a professor, what would you say when someone about beauty? Because beauty can be very subjective.
Right. So this is the biggest question in the branch of philosophy known as aesthetics. And, you know, we've seen great writings from the Greeks, the Hellenists, Hume, Kant, Schiller, Hegel, Schopenhauer, Santayana. And the question is whether beauty is entirely subjective or has objective characteristics as well. So if it's entirely subjective, then meaning seems to break down completely. You have such a radicalization of the notion of beauty that it means absolutely nothing. It could be anything without some kind of objective standard that we can express mathematically or conceptually. So that it's a great debate. And the way I can hook it into what we're talking about otherwise, Nazarita, is that there's been, it started with morality, and we happen to be talking about morality, but there has been this giant debate about the objectivity of morality and the subjectivity of morality in the context of what we call moral relativism. And so if morality breaks down to just what a culture says it is, which is moral relativism, moral subjectivism is just a species of relativism. You can make anything right and anything wrong in that kind of a conception. And the same with beauty. So the critique has perennially been that there has to be an objective accounting of beauty in some way. And so people have tried to define beauty, Plotinus, for one, Locke, and tried to define beauty as having some kind of objective mathematical characteristics. So, for example, there's been quite a bit of research interculturally about standards of facial beauty. And so if you take a culture, you can question 1 million people in a culture and take all that data, and you can figure out, you can correlate that with certain bone structure, ratios and distances between eyes, nose, mouth, jaw bones, etc. And you can actually get to the point where there's an objective correlate of what that culture thinks of as beauty. So that's been tried. I'm not saying I think that gets us anywhere. But then you have you know, famous correlates like beauty is truth, truth beauty, which I want to sit on for a little bit here. How can truth be beauty, right? How can they converge? How can beauty be truth? If you listen to Mozart, for example, and at a very loud volume, it will make you cry. There is such an exquisite beauty and emotional rapture in listening to Mozart like no other. There's something that seems to be universally felt and experienced and understood in Mozart, and indeed the great classically trained musicians will tell you why Mozart is beauty, right? They can explain it analytically. Take a top 10 tennis player in the world. You can analyze their play, right? You can analyze each part of it, and you can explain why they approach perfection, same in gymnastics. And yet we can have an experience of the best tennis player or the best gymnast or even the best chess player, whatever it is, and we can say their quality or their skill is so great that it approaches, it becomes the model of truth. Michael Jordan, for example, was the example of a perfect basketball player. Everything about his basketball playing was truth, or the essence of what basketball is, and it also then evokes that subjective experience. So there seems to be a correlation between a beautiful sculpture or a beautiful house or a beautifully designed room and the subjective judgment of the people. You know, we might even say, you know, this is not my taste about a certain interior design. You might say, this is not my taste, but it's certainly beautiful. So Kant, who got his mind into everything, argued that when we make a judgment that something is beautiful, we have to make a disinterested judgment. It has to be more than an interested judgment. And so this is Kant, again, being the rationalist that he is, and making this argument. And so I would say, Nazarita, that when I think of critical design of an interior of a house, an interior of a business, a town, an ecosystem, how, you know, humans are developing, say, a community on a rural side of town where there are many animals and there are many ecosystems already there. Whatever it is that we build there, whatever it is that we design there for housing or infrastructure, to be beautiful would mean that we would be super aware. We would be perspicacious, perceptive of what is already there, the truth of what is already there. And we would build with that totally in mind. And in that awareness and in that careful implementation, we would be both critical and beautiful at the same time. So, I mean, these are just some opening comments. I've not really considered them as much as I want to, but this opens up a great exploration for me to think about how a critical design can do something, but that it's also descriptively beautiful. And so can something be beautiful and non-functional? Absolutely. There's no question about it. Can something be functional and not that beautiful? I suppose that's true as well. But where they converge, there seems to be something different afoot. You know, and you take the great masters of oil painting or the great city designers, people who are now building cities of the future. So critical design, as you and I've been discussing it, has a moral component. It has a critical thinking component. It has a creative component. And I think there is a measure of beauty somewhere in there. I'm just not sure where it's located yet. So that's my opening couple of comments about that.
Well, here's what's interesting. I think culture actually, except for the very few, defines the majority of people's idea of beauty. And that's just kind of the way it is. If you look at like the Victorian era, which, you know, it was a time of the Industrial Revolution, Queen Victoria, and Charles Dickens, Charles Darwin, telephone, telegraph, railway, all those things happened during that time. And if you look at the houses during the Victorian era, if we're talking, we could just look at interior design for that matter right now. And the houses were like packed with things. Like they were full of oddities of nature. That was a big thing. Big greenhouses, and I believe, looking back, that what was going on was this great division between nature and a so-called progress of technology, Industrial Revolution, is that we had this immense beginning split inside. And so interiors, they were collecting natural specimens under glass. They were butterflies on the walls, you know, bones. And if you really look at those, it's really interesting. Plus, they had these huge greenhouses where they used to have lots of specimens of plants. And this is really interesting when you really look at it. It isn't just the Victorian decor, it is showing something happening within humans, that they're thinking, they're actually acting out this great divide that is going on in culture between their integration of nature and then having this great Industrial Revolution. So nowadays, popular is the furniture styles, we're all trying to go back and have simplicity. And that's because we're so bombarded with so much through social media and through the news and technology that we're trying to embrace a different kind of simplicity. And I find this interesting because it is acting out in everything that we do. Our phones, we like more simplistic stuff. We think of it as more beautiful. If we see something, a piece of furniture, if we see a yard, we don't like a lot of stuff around. And that's because we're trying to recapture our integration with nature. We're bringing more plants in. We're trying to simplify where we live. The tiny house movement. This is all a product of what we're doing now. Our culture. Our culture has overwhelmed everyone to the point where they're desiring a more simple way of living, a way of viewing, and that creates a beauty that is different than it was in the Victorian era. And so, like we talked about before, culture dictates virtue. It dictates who we are unless we're extremely aware. And that's where, I guess, awareness comes in. If we're aware of what's going on, and we talked about truth, so truth is not different for every error. Culturally, truth may be, but inwardly, truth, like we're all connected, If there's a fire in California, you're going to smell the smoke in the rest of the United States. And that's the interconnectedness. And, you know, this has been around for millions of years. Like, if you do something with the right hand, the left hand's going to know it. And we're not disconnected. We're not alienated, really, at the heart. We may consider ourselves alienated from nature or from other species, but in reality, we're not. And we're paying the price for that now. And that's why we're talking about this, the idea of beauty. And that's why we're talking about what is culture, what have we created in culture that is causing this great split in humanity? Just say there's a violence, and then this escalating violence in all areas of life, and then the opposite of the other side, the interconnectedness, is that if we're violent to one, we're really violent to ourselves. So we're seeing this acting out in every kind of culture. You have the extreme wealth, which have all the toys and the bells and whistles and great huge mansions where they can't even live in part of it. And then you see people in really tiny houses. It's this great divide that is happening in our species. And, you know, someone with a big mansion may think what's beautiful is more rooms. More rooms, more toys, you know. We got the tennis court here, and we got the swimming pool here, and we got the bowling alley, and we got the barbershop, all contained in their houses. And then you have the tiny house movement where you have very few things, but you're more connected with nature. And so beauty is dictated partially by culture. And when you find something that is ugly, but someone considers it beautiful, there's usually this radical impetus to change. Change is the movement of beauty. Beauty looks ugly in some ways when it's changed, like paintings. Paintings, sometimes the purpose is functional. It causes a change in our viewing, in our listening. Music is actually functional because it causes us to have a change of mood, a change of intention. You hear a beautiful piece of music and you're inspired. You're inspired to do something, to be better, to do more, where straight-edge music inspires violence. let's be real. It inspires violence. So that's all connected to our culture and what our intentions are as a group and what we're choosing. And it will dictate our future.
Thank you very much for all that. One of the things I pulled out of what you're saying is there's a difference between moral universalism and moral relativism. And moral relativism states that what is good and what is bad, what is right and what is wrong, is just what a culture says it is. And the whole impetus behind moral relativism is tolerance, that we ought not judge people of a different culture, no matter what it is they do. So for example, we shouldn't judge the South Koreans for torturing dogs and then burning them to death and then eating them. Moral relativism says, oh, in their culture, that's morally correct, and therefore that's we should be tolerant. Moral universalism is a harder and more difficult moral position, because it means we have to cut through all cultures and see if we can find some absolute or universal principles for all human experience. And that's something that, you know, Kant develops a formal system on. Plato himself develops the forms. And there really is an algorithm, a deep, intricate beauty of an ecosystem that's running well. For example, in the forests of Montana, in the rainforests of South America, there's a complexity that can be mapped out mathematically and logically, but it also brings us an experience, an emotional experience. Let's see, Santayana in 1896 a great philosopher, by the way, Santayana, 1896, says, we've now reached our definition of beauty, which in the terms of our successive analysis and narrowing of the conception is value positive. So it has a positive value. It's an intrinsic and objectified pleasure regarded as the quality of a thing. Beauty is a value. That is, it is not a perception of a matter of fact or of a relation. It is an emotion, an affection of our volitional and appreciative nature. An object cannot be beautiful if it can give pleasure to nobody. A beauty to which all men were forever indifferent is a contradiction in terms. Beauty is therefore a positive value that is intrinsic. It's a pleasure. And that comes from his famous book in 1896, The Sense of Beauty, page 50-51. Arthur Danto, who was a fantastic philosopher, he actually wrote on Sartre and existentialism. In 2003, wrote a book called The Abuse of Beauty. And so bastardized and I think distorted the idea of beauty in our world, Nazarita, because all values have been subjugated to the value of acquisition, possession, commodification, capitalism. This acquisition, this need to take in more and more and more and to accumulate. That's different than accumulating for good reasons and good purposes. You accumulate to create systems that promote the good. I'm talking about accumulation for its own sake, in which those accumulators end up exploiting the earth, exploiting animals, exploiting other humans, and they spend money on items and processes and goods that don't really serve any purpose for the good of all, for the community. So in Santayana, we see some deep truth. Beauty has to be value positive. We can write a paper on that. It has to be intrinsic to the item. And it does have to have an objective element as well. Hang on a sec here. So when you go back to Plato, his notion of the good, he was attempting a great systematic philosophy. Aristotle, when he urges us to pursue the good. And that's what virtue is. Today's topic is virtue. We're talking about virtue and beauty being a property of virtue or at least converging with virtue. So Crispin Sartwell in 2004 wrote a book called Six Names of Beauty, attributes beauty neither exclusively to the subject nor to the object, but to the relation between them, and even more widely to the situation or environment which they're both embedded. He points out that when we attribute beauty to the night sky, we do not take ourselves simply to be reporting a state of pleasure in ourselves. We are turned outward toward it. We are celebrating the real world. And this is really a brilliant part in his concept, that beauty arises at the conjunction of the subjective and the objective, the overcoming of dualism, where the subject and the object are totally connected. Now, I can tell our listeners 100% that this is true, that going out in the middle of the night, as I've been doing every night for weeks, and looking at the night sky and all the beautiful stars, last night I was out. I was very in the middle of the night, and I was half asleep, and I held my head up and started looking at all the constellations that I could find and mapping them in my mind and seeing if I could recognize any, and just appreciating. There was a transcendental quality, Nazarita. I definitely had an emotional experience. I wanted to cry, tears of great joy. I felt so connected to the sky and so connected to the stars, and was filled with wonder, was filled with a sense of hope. And I was sharing this with a little dog who also appreciates the night sky. I don't know why, but he does. And there was this overwhelming sense of belonging and possibility. Alexander Nehemas, that's Nehamas, who is a great Nietzschean scholar, writes a book, Only a Promise of Happiness, in 07, characterizes beauty as an invitation to further experience, a way that things invite us in. The beautiful object invites us to explore and interpret. So it's not just an instantaneous feature. It's not just surface. So this is really interesting, because when I think about the best literary works I've ever read, when I think about my very best work as a writer, were the best drawings or paintings that I've appreciated in my life, or a song, they invite me deeper. They invite me into that Marcellian notion of receptivity, openness, letting the world in, becoming available, really connecting with everything else, and realizing that I don't have to stuff everything in me, but that I can be part of this grandeur. And there's something that, as we're talking, Nazarita, I see, there's something in a connection between the transcendence of my ego, and allowing me to participate. There's the word I've been hunting for this whole show, is participation. Beauty allows me to participate. So that's where I want to stop. What do you think about that?
That's really interesting. I really like the one quote, because that was everything that we were just talking about, that beauty changes, and beauty does allow us to participate. I know that there, we can really look at, and we probably know some people who concentrate on the ugliness of the world and therefore miss any of the beauty of the world. And so that's the duality of humans. There's beauty and there's ugliness. And what causes us to think that something is beautiful or ugly? You know, humans are programmed internally to think that, baby faces are beautiful. We want to protect and nurture, a certain spacing of the eyes, a bigger forehead, a mouth a certain way, and really skinny babies and babies that don't have fat on them, that we're less able to bond with. And this is the way humans are meant to try and nurture their young. And so they have this idea of that's the beauty. The beauty is in, this facial features that need to be protected. It stimulates in a means of protection. And so I've often been inspired by beauty. And I've been inspired by beauty in nature, man-made beauty in terms of paintings and music. And it inspires a change. A change to internal, right? Right.
Right. That's transcendence. That's a transcendental feature of humanity.
Right.
To be inspired to change. So with our
right.
2 minutes left, do you want to
yeah.
give us a conclusion, and then we can come back to it next week?
No, go right ahead.
Well, I just want to say
I really
thank
was
you.
Interested.
this is great. We're going to come back to this next week. Beauty as a part of critical design. I would suggest to everybody to read Aristotle's Poetics, especially Volume 2, his Metaphysics, Euclid's Elements. We've got to read Euclid. We all have to read Euclid's Elements. And then also the sculptor Polykleitos, who was 5th century BCE. He wrote something called the Canon. And he did a lot of this discussion about symmetry. So we can come back at this. I think we've really hit upon something important. And especially now, Zarita, in our conversation about overcoming metaphysical dualism, if there's a convergence in mathematical formulation, form, beauty, virtue, truth, I would think that most people would want to know what that is. You know, just like we were discussing Professor Bohm last week and how some of his late theories in physics were beautiful. There's a real beauty in Dr. Bohm's conception of the universe. So we want to pick that up next time. I've got it written down. So make sure you read your Aristotle Poetics, your Euclid Elements. Think about these questions. Think about how beauty relates to critical design, how it relates to nonviolence. Is nonviolence beautiful? Let's look at all that. Let's see how these things hook up together. What is their synthesis? In synthesis, there's truth. That I can guarantee you. So thank you, Nazarita Goldhammer. Thank you for all of our listeners. Go to Amazon.com. All of our radio conversation books are for sale for cheap prices. This is Epis Radio signing off. Thank you very much.